Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 255. Yes, 255. We're just marching right along of the Fun with Cars Formula One podcast. I'm Robin Warner, and today I'm joined by the man some call the cricket condoner, Chris Roche. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Robin. Condoner. I do condone cricket. It's a fabulous sport.
It is the most confusing concoction of rules and random numbers thrown together that some people think make sense. I can't get my head around it.
Well, it is very civilized sport. It's the only sport I know that stops for afternoon tea, for example.
The warm variety. And then carries on for three or four more days. Who has that kind of time?
It's a five-day game, mate. You know, you don't want to rush these things.
and yet here we are talking about something that is, by comparison, very rushed, because today we're going to talk about both the Austrian and the British Grand Prix, which were the 9th and 10th rounds of the Formula One Championship. It is Wednesday evening, July 17th, and here are the results of both the Austrian and British Grand Prix. In Austria, it was Max Verstappen in the Red Bull Racing Honda. That's Honda. He was the lead car. He was followed by Charles Leclerc of the lead Ferrari in second. Valtteri Bottas was third in the lead Mercedes. Sebastian Vettel was fourth in the second Ferrari. Lewis Hamilton was fifth in the second Mercedes. Already, those results aren't terribly used to hearing. But anyway, in sixth place, a very well done job by Lando Norris in the lead McLaren Renault. Seventh place went to Pierre Gasly in the Red Bull Racing Honda, and that is Chris Roche's favorite driver. Eighth place, Carlos Sainz in the second McLaren Renault. Ninth place, Kimi Raikkonen in the lead Alfa Romeo Racing Ferrari, followed by his teammate Antonio Giovinazzi in 10th, collecting the final point. 11th place went to the lead Racing Point driver Sergio Perez. 12th place was the lead Renault of Daniel Ricciardo, followed by his teammate Nico Hülkenberg in 13th. 14th place went to the second Racing Point Mercedes, Lance Stroll. 15th went to Alexander Albon in the lead Scuderia Toro Rosso Honda. 16th, the lead Haas Ferrari, Romain Grosjean. 17th, Daniel Kvyat in the second Toro Rosso Honda. 18th place, the lead Williams, George Russell. It's normalizing for me now. It doesn't shock me anymore. 19th place, the second Haas Ferrari, Kevin Magnussen. And 20th place, a familiar place, Robert Kubica in the second Williams Mercedes. That was Austria. In England, in the jolly old country, it was, drum roll, Lewis Hamilton winning the race for the sixth time at the British Grand Prix.
What a relief. Normality is resumed.
And even more normal, in second place, he was followed by his teammate Valtteri Bottas in the second Mercedes. Third place went to Charles Leclerc in the leading Ferrari. I think the lead Ferrari and Charles Leclerc is going to be more and more common. Fourth place, oh yeah, the lead Red Bull Racing Honda, Pierre Gasly. Fifth place, Max Verstappen in the second Red Bull Racing Honda. Sixth place went to Carlos Sainz in the lead McLaren Renault. Seventh place, Daniel Ricciardo in the lead factory Renault. Eighth place went to Kimi Raikkonen in the lead Alfa Romeo Racing Ferrari. Ninth place, Daniel Kvyat in the lead Scuderia Toro Rosso Honda. 10th place went to Nico Hülkenberg in the second Renault. 11th place went to Lando Norris in the second McLaren Renault. 12th place went to Alexander Albon in the second Scuderia Toro Rosso Honda. 13th place went to Lance Stroll in the lead Racing Point Mercedes. 14th place, George Russell in the lead Williams Mercedes. 15th was teammate Robert Kubica in the second Williams Mercedes. 16th place, Sebastian Vettel in the second Ferrari. 17th place, Sergio Perez in the second Racing Point Mercedes. And then the last three were not classified, and that was Antonio Giovinazzi in the second Alfa Romeo Racing Ferrari, and both Haas Ferrari drivers, first Romain Grosjean, then Kevin Magnussen. Chris, quite a couple of races that we have to talk about. What do you have to say?
Well, I'd like to start with the epic amount of fallout after France and all of the hand-wringing about how F1's so terrible and so boring and the rules need to be rewritten. And then we get treated to two cracking races. I mean, you know, they were vintage, almost vintage F1, I would suggest. A lot of great action. So all those who claim that the formula should be rewritten, maybe you shouldn't have spoken quite so soon, so quickly.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like global warming, right? The second it snows, people are like, well, global warming's a hoax, clearly. And it's like, no, it just snowed today. So how much is it there's still a problem and we got a couple of great races in? And how much of it is there was never a problem and the problem was the anomaly?
But what other sport do you know where it's a little bit dull, that particular game of football, soccer, hockey, you name it, where someone declares immediately after the end of the game that wasn't that interesting, that the rules should be rewritten? I can't think of another sport like that. In Formula One, we constantly have this dialogue about things have to change. Okay, I think maybe we should just accept that some races are good and some races are not so good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a bad person to ask because I don't watch any of those other sports. So, yeah, to me, they're all dull and they need to be changed.
Okay.
But I see your point, but I think that there are some fundamental issues that can be looked at where general trends can be looked at, thought about in aggregate, these types of things. And I think one thing that has to be considered is the excellent point that these last two races have brought up, and that's the nature of the racetracks themselves. Thinking just a little bit more carefully about the quality of the racing at the racetrack as opposed to the financial value of the location that the racetrack is located. So, you know, generally speaking, Canada puts on a great race. It's much more rare for Canada to be boring than it is for Canada to be exciting. British Grand Prix tends to be that way as well. Austria tends to have good results. Spa is always great. Japan, Suzuka is often good. So, I don't know. I think in a way it almost strengthens the argument that some things need to be addressed.
So just not go back to France then. That's the conclusion.
Well, it wasn't just France. But yeah, well, maybe that's the conclusion.
But okay, so
bring back Magny Cours, right? That one was always great, right?
No, it was dull as ditch water. So anyway, I've delayed you long enough. How happy are you that Honda finally won again after all these seasons of torture?
I have no official affiliation or desire for Honda to do well. I just had an understanding that the tenacity of that company meant that they would eventually do well again. And they went through some fits and starts. They went through some trying times in this modern era, certainly. But, you know, obviously they found a much better partner in Red Bull than they had in McLaren. And this is a track. They wanted a track where power is not the most paramount criteria, and everything came together. So I'm happy for them. I'm very happy for them. But I'd be happy for Renault if Renault had a breakthrough performance as well. More than anything, I take pleasure in giving you a hard time. So if you want, start digging on Renault, and then I'll start taking some real glee in their performance if they improve.
I mean, so 2006 was Honda's last win. Hungary for Jenson Button.
Yeah.
You know,
brilliant win.
It was a brilliant win. But who would have thought it would take 13 years for them to win again? Shocking.
To be fair, they were not in the sport the entire time.
Well, that's true.
They left after the 2008 season, and they returned, was it 2014? No, 2015.
Was it really? Or was it 18 or 19?
Well, it's funny though. I'll take this time to endorse your suggestion. I've been listening to Beyond the Grid, the podcast with Tom Clarkson, I believe it is.
It is indeed.
Any relation to Jeremy Clarkson? I think I've asked that before.
No,
it certainly doesn't seem it.
He's far too measured.
Yeah, exactly. But it has been a very good podcast to listen to. If there's anyone that listens to our podcast that has any connection to Tom Clarkson, please do give the Fun with Cars 2 thumbs up to him and let him know that we would absolutely be delighted to ever chat with him and tell us a little bit about his love of racing, and we'd promote his podcast to our to people because it's a great podcast. But he recently had Ross Braun on his show, and Ross Braun talked about the one and only year, the less than 12 months of Braun GP, and how basically he gave Honda a lot of credit for Braun GP's success. And I found that really fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, you're right. I mean, the car was basically done before Honda pulled the plug, right? And I mean, Braun was very smart, managed to find an alternative engine, managed to get it, you know, well integrated with that chassis that had been designed for the original Honda unit, and did a good job, no doubt. But yeah, I think it was Honda's big push to finally, you know, make a bid for the championship. That Braun benefited from it, but you know, not many people, not everyone would have taken the risk to run the team that year. You know, very close to folding, so it was a pretty good job all round, really.
Yeah, no, definitely so. And I'm certainly not trying to diminish what Braun himself pulled off, but it was fascinating to me how much credit he gave Honda and how much he spoke about Honda's chassis. The chassis being developed by Honda, pretty much it was done before he took over. And it was also fascinating to me that both Ferrari and Mercedes offered engines for him. And the Mercedes, the reason why they chose Mercedes, because it was less work to adopt it to the Honda chassis than the Ferrari would have been. Mm. That was the reason. Not because it was the most powerful or anything like that. At least he didn't claim so publicly.
Well, and of course, quite a number of people who worked on that that car actually work for Mercedes Grand Prix these days, and they're doing rather well now as well.
Well, I do believe the British Grand Prix is their 7th 1-2 of the season out of 10 rounds.
Yeah, but I think we should give Max some kudos before we move on. I mean, that was an epic win for him.
Oh, like, man, definitely
epic,
so.
Epic. I mean, The poor start, you know, it was easy to dismiss him as a threat in the race after he dropped well down the order off the start line.
Can I tell you why I think he had such a poor start?
Yeah, sure.
He was so nervous about Pierre Gasly hunting him down that he just let nerves get away with him, and he just lost it.
You know, the ironic thing is, I would have won the bet if we hadn't have had the crash in Canadian qualifying. He actually didn't get within 2/10, even at Silverstone.
But he did. He was within 3/10 at Silverstone.
Yeah, but Verstappen had a Honda engine problem.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
But the bet was looking at the numbers.
Anyway.
So, I mean,
so then yet another reason to love Canada. See, you're just giving me more reasons to appreciate Montreal and all its glory.
Max's drive was phenomenal, and you know, he deserves pretty much all the praise he's getting at the moment. I mean, some of the moves, the absolute awesome pace, the consistency. He did spoil it a little bit for me with the move that ultimately got him the win. I thought he was a little bit tough on Charles. I personally disagreed with him. I didn't think that was fair racing, or hard racing as he called it. I thought that was illegal racing. I'm surprised he didn't get a penalty for it, but he didn't. The stewards made the decisions, and he won fair and square. So he did, you know, get his comeuppance at Silverstone. Leclerc got his own back, I think it's fair to say, but we can come on to that a bit later. But yeah, I mean, it was a feisty old drive, he, you know, good to see somebody else win.
What did you think? I definitely want to talk about that non-penalty. It was reviewed. My curiosity is, how much do you think the backlash that the stewards received in Canada that cost someone the race win played a role in their non-penalty decision for Verstappen, because I agree with you. I looked at that move and I was like, ooh, that's questionable.
Well, they don't have. I mean, one of the issues with the steward system at the moment is it's not the same stewards every race weekend, which is a problem. So if you want consistency in the application of the rules, you probably want to have the same stewards every race, but they don't
have
that.
Well, I thought there was some of those guys did come to every race, but then that was that a driver, like a former high-level driver, would come in and be a guest steward for the different Grand Prix, and that's what rotates. But I thought generally the panel was the same group.
Yeah, I think you're right. There is one or two members that are consistent, but I don't know who has the ultimate authority. I don't know if it's, you know, it has to be unanimous or, you know, one person can influence the others. I mean, I think it's great to have ex-drivers on the steward panel, but you probably should pick the same one for the season. Maybe rotate on a seasonal basis. But to me, it's, you know, that's one discrepancy there. But I thought, you know, the lap prior to the actual overtake, where they went side by side through, what was it, turn three, and Leclerc was able to get the pass back, was fantastic. That, to me, was awesome racing.
Completely agree.
And then the next lap, he just barged him off the track and obviously was able to hold the position. And I just felt that sullied the win for me a little bit, but not too much, because it was still an epic drive by Max.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree, and I was certainly nervous. That race weekend happened while I was at the Pikes Peak International Hill Climb. I was very good about avoiding news of the race, other than someone said, I just saw on his local, like, internal messaging system, I just saw that once again the stewards have control of the race-winning result. And I said, oh, no. What happened? So as I'm watching the race, and then I see what happens with Verstappen and Leclerc, I'm like, oh, man, this is tape delayed. I watched it on Monday. And I was like, oh, man, okay, so Honda's not going to actually get this. So when he did get it, I was actually relieved in some ways, because I do think that rightly or wrongly, the stewards would have gotten more backlash for, quote-unquote, deciding the race winner, even though the case in Montreal, I thought, was justified.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an easy situation, and you certainly don't want the race to be overturned 3 hours after the flag has flown. So I do sympathise a little bit with the steward situation. I think, you know, the nature of the tracks with these big runoff areas does lend itself to this sort of barge mentality. But, yeah, I really disagree with Verstappen's opinion that was hard racing. I think that was over the line, but... But, you know, it was a great drive by the future of Formula One. Leclerc and Verstappen are probably going to be up there for quite a while to come. And I think we're going to see a lot more battles like that, which will be exciting.
They are within a year of each other in age, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. And they've been racing each other through the junior formula as well. So
this
isn't new for them.
Yeah, and I was surprised, although not terribly, to see... in qualifying, how Leclerc was ahead of Vettel. I wondered if this was the beginning of the end. You know, Leclerc put the thing on pole. Did Vettel have a problem with the car?
Yeah, he had a leak and did get out in Q3, to be fair to him.
But, you know, there Vettel was. Where did he end up? Because I think there were some penalties shuffling things around.
Ninth
on the grid.
Yeah, he qualified 10th, started 19th.
Yeah, and, you know, there Leclerc is on pole, and I'm like, oh, geez. And then I'll skip ahead for a moment. It happened again in England. I was like, oh, geez, this is not looking good for Vettel. I mean, there's definitely more to talk about with Vettel. But just, I mean, sticking with Austria, Lando Norris had a fantastic performance.
He did. The dicing at the start of the race by Norris was epic, actually. I mean, and Gasly was in the mix too. It was very entertaining with a lot of drivers giving it a good go. But it was clean racing, you know? That was what was good about it.
Yeah, it was clean racing. There was racing. Now, you brought this up at the beginning, and I will take this time. I certainly agree with you. It was a great race. It was an entertaining race. It was an engaging race. That does not mean the racing would not have been improved even more if the cars were less aero-sensitive. So I don't think this means leave the cars alone as they are just because we had a great race. I think the racing still could have been better.
Look, I mean, we know that there's moves afoot to make the cars less aerosensitive, to try and improve the tyre situation, even refueling's on the table, although there's some of us who have long enough memories to remember that racing wasn't always great when there was refueling. But there is an effort to improve the racing. I really can't stand the post-mortems that we have, you know, every time there's not epic racing for 50, 60 laps. I mean, it's been like this through the history of F1 since the 50s. You just go back and look at the records.
The difference is, and this will be, I won't belabor this point, but the difference is that back then there was just so much more outwardly obvious experimentation going on. And so it was so much easier to see when someone got it right and someone got it wrong. And I think that carried the sport along more so, even though there wasn't necessarily as much epic racing as people would like to remember.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't stop me tuning in. I think it doesn't stop the majority of people tuning in. And I think it only, the incessant complaining just doesn't help the situation. So anyway, what about Hamilton? I mean, that was quite a bad weekend. Mistake in Q3, demoted him to fourth on the grid. Then he damages his wing during the race. Car was slow. Got beaten by his teammate. Obviously, the championship's fallen apart.
Oh, yeah. No, Hamilton's done. I mean, there's no chance he's going to get the championship this year after a performance like that. He's out.
Shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's no way. Yeah. No, I mean, it's so funny. You know, you're just talking about, like, oh, one, you know, a couple bad Grand Prix and everyone's complaining about the sport. Now we have these epic races. You know, Hamilton having a bad Grand Prix, to me, was almost a relief. It's like, oh, okay, good. He is still human. You know, he's become such a complete driver in terms of PR and marketing capability for the team, you know, being nice, saying the right things, very thankful, very much a team player, always praising the team for their work and their efforts whenever he's on the podium, things like that. Obviously still demonstrably quick, obviously still quite good at developing the car and getting them going in the right direction. He is definitely the strongest driver in Formula One by a pretty decent margin now.
Christian Horner would disagree with you there. He thinks Max is the number one driver now.
Of course he thinks that. Of course he thinks it. He probably gets a $50,000 bonus every time he finds a way to rope that into the conversation.
I didn't mention that Pierre was number two, though, did he?
Listen, Max is quick. He is obviously quite good at getting lap times out of the car, and he's obviously proven as well that he's not going to bang the car up over a race distance. He can bring it home, but he still makes rash decisions on the racetrack. He still says some very odd things off the racetrack, and he can be quite dismissive to reporters and things like that. That's what I mean. Like, you know, Hamilton, he does all the good. He doesn't do the bad anymore.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, Verstappen was behind Gasly at the start of the race after Verstappen's poor start. And he obviously, Max won the race and Gasly finished, what, seventh? His situation at the team was looking very, very precarious after Austria.
Indeed.
He did pull his socks up a little bit for Silverstone. But I honestly thought he might be on the way out after Austria.
Do you think it was his socks? Do you think that was the issue?
I think it could be anything and everything that's hampering his pace.
Yeah, no, I listen, definitely the rumors around Gasly were not going to go to end. Helmut Marko was making it pretty plain that he was quickly losing patience. So this is as good of a time as any to point out that at the British Grand Prix, Pierre Gasly did outperform Verstappen.
Ooh, what?
Well,
are you gonna really stand by that statement?
Well, no, I don't. Outperform is the wrong word.
Yeah, he outfinished.
He, he finished ahead of Max Verstappen.
Did he get rammed by a Ferrari at any point during the race?
That's why I know. I couldn't even. I wouldn't be able to fake that one. That was. But he did perform better than he had. He was closer to Verstappen than he had been. Yes, Verstappen wasn't terribly happy with his qualifying performance in England, but you're never happy with a qualifying performance when you're not qualifying as well as you'd want. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, he'd only be truly happy if he put the car on pole or whatever. So, Gasly has improved his performance. Is that enough to keep him past summer break? Who knows?
I mean, my yardstick is this, right? The top three teams have a big enough gap over the rest of the field that you would expect anyone in one of those six cars to be finishing the top six given a normal race. And Gasly just hasn't been able to do that up until Silverstone. Finally, he qualified in the top six. He pipped Vettel. He was fifth on the grid. And then he finished fourth. It probably shouldn't have been fourth. He probably should have finished sixth in a clean race. But that's still where you'd expect someone to be in a car of a Red Bull caliber. So that's finally halfway through the season getting to where he should be. I think if his performance dips in the next couple of Grand Prix, Hungary, Germany, he's gone. I think this has given him a stay of execution, but I think the executioner's axe is still being sharpened.
Well, that's a fair point. But let's talk about the British Grand Prix a little bit. It was absolutely a great, great race. It was Lewis Hamilton and Valtteri Bottas finishing 1-2. It was incredibly lucky that it was Hamilton first.
What?
Valtteri second.
My goodness, did you watch this race? Did you watch this?
No, hold on. No,
that's
hold
an
on.
Outrageous statement. That's
it's
worse
not.
Than... Okay.
It's not because as the Grand Prix could have set out, it could have very well been that Hamilton found a way around Valtteri sooner or later anyway. Uh-huh. Yeah. His pace was clearly strong.
So the 17.5-second lead before the pace car was irrelevant, was it?
Yeah, 17.5-second lead.
They both had one stop to make.
Okay, you're forgetting a pretty large portion of the Grand Prix where Valtteri outqualified Hamilton.
By 6,000?
Hamilton, yeah. By 6,000. Hamilton was pushing hard to get around Valtteri, past Valtteri.
Yeah, yeah.
Valtteri passed him right back.
Absolutely. That was epic and really good for Bottas. I was impressed with that. Definitely.
And held on the lead until Valtteri's pit stop.
Yep.
Okay.
But he had to pit then because his tires were gone.
Okay. Right? So Valtteri pitted.
Point, right?
Fair. Fine. Valtteri pitted.
Yeah.
And they were showing us, like, okay, so is Hamilton going to try to do an overcut on Valtteri, really push, get a couple of epic laps in, and then pit and come out ahead of Valtteri? And the lap times were showing that Hamilton wasn't getting it done. Valtteri's pace was too fast for Hamilton to overcome him that way.
Ooh,
then...
No, hang on. I've got to correct you there. So we got Hamilton on 16-lap-old medium compound tyres, yeah? And we got Bottas on brand new medium compound tyres, and they were running the same pace.
Valtteri was faster, only just, but he was faster.
Yeah, he was gaining about 0.2 a lap. You're right. But not
so it then, would so not have it would not have been enough had it been normal sequence. It would not have been enough. Valtteri, given normal pit stops, everything else, Valtteri would have retained the lead after the pit stop cycled through.
Well, you're missing the rather significant point, right? So Bottas pitted and put the same compound tyre on as he had in the first stint. That forced him into another pit stop. So Valtteri was on a two-stop strategy. Hamilton stated right at the beginning of the race that he was going for a one-stop strategy. So he went from medium to hard. I think Bottas's mistake was he should have fitted hard compound tyres at that stop to give himself the option of running the rest of the race without another stop. But he didn't do that. He committed to a two-stop. And Hamilton's intention was to run a one-stop, which meant that he would have easily won because he was 17.5 seconds ahead. They both had a stop to make.
Okay, hold on, though. You're making some pretty large assumptions here, because what helped make the one-stop strategy more comfortable and easier was the fact that there were several laps run under yellow because of a safety car. Because of, was it Nico Hülkenberg?
No, Giovinazzi.
Giovinazzi spun off into the sunset, got stuck in the gravel trap, and they didn't do a virtual safety car. They did an actual safety car, which gave Hamilton a huge opportunity to get a free pit stop in and not take the time penalty around, because he got the pit stop when everyone else was chugging along nice and slow. All right. So
I don't disagree with that point, that the safety car made it easier for Hamilton.
The safety car made it easier for the tires to last longer. So that helped him that way as well.
Okay, but the point is that the Friday free practice indicated that Hamilton's long run pace on the medium compound tires was very good, and it was better than his teammates. They never ran the hard compound tire in free practice because they only took one set. So they rolled the dice. No one quite knew how long the Pirelli hard would last for. But the point being is there was a huge differential in pace. So even after the safety car, okay, so you're right, Hamilton gets his free stop, right? Bottas makes his stop. Bottas couldn't hang on to Hamilton on the same compound tire. They were both on hards at this point, and Hamilton just pulled away. Now, Bottas then stopped again for soft tyres and was able to set fastest lap, which Hamilton then subsequently beat on 32-lap-old. Oh, thank you. 32. That would be a very old
tire. Yes, exactly, yeah.
On his last lap of the race. I mean, that just shows you the difference in ultimate pace between the two drivers.
Those facts are true, but there's tons of mitigating circumstances. You know for a fact that is it a lot easier to control a race, control race pace, to control tire wear, control all those things when you're in front of the race, leading the race. And you also know that if Bottas, after the first round of pit stops, retained the lead because there wasn't a safety car, that could have done all sorts of things to change Hamilton's strategy and tire wear and all those things. So I don't think it's fair to assume that it would have been an inevitability without that very obvious advantage that Hamilton gained from the safety car.
I don't disagree that Bottas didn't get any luck. I mean, he did a good job getting it on pole, and he did a good job defending from Hamilton. I mean, Hamilton's attacks in the opening laps were like a man possessed. I mean, it was pretty good to watch.
Yeah,
and he managed to hold him off, and fair play. And then he didn't have any luck because he'd committed to his first stop, and then the safety car came out. So I don't disagree with you there, but I think he might be overlooking the ultimate pace differential between the two on the same tire.
I really feel like I'm not overlooking. I'm certainly not trying to say that Bottas definitely would have won were it not for the safety car. I'm certainly not suggesting that, but it was definitely plenty of luck handled to Hamilton to make that quest a whole lot easier. And also, the reason why Bottas's tires were struggling as much as they were is because he was defending against Hamilton so much in those first opening laps. And
interesting statement. Isn't it normally the car that follows that hurts the tires more rather than the car that leads?
Well, it depends. And this is, Hamilton is quite good. I showered him with praise not 15 minutes ago. Bottas was driving sloppier. He was driving defensively and he was struggling, but he managed to hold on. So,
yep, hold on to second. Very good.
Okay, listen.
Move on to the next.
Are you still upset that Nico Hülkenberg won the championship in 2016? Is that what this is about? And the other thing I want to point out, this was not the Finnish Grand Prix. This was the British Grand Prix.
Hülkenberg,
this
was Hamilton's. It was Rosberg, by the way.
Shit, did I do it again?
You did.
Sorry for swearing, everybody.
Does Hülkenberg pay you $10 every time you claim he's the world champion?
Nico Rosberg, 2016. Nico Hülkenberg in Renault today.
I've forgotten who won that championship.
My God. Listen, my point is that this was not the Finnish Grand Prix. This was the British Grand Prix. This is Hamilton's home race. This is a racetrack that he knows extremely well. He's been extremely successful. And Bottas took pole from him. And Bottas was holding on to the lead against Lewis Hamilton in the same equipment. that deserves tons of praise. He held off five-time champion and
16 laps. It was 52-lap race. It was epic.
16 laps and a safety car. You're like, the safety car didn't happen. Did you turn the race off for 10 laps right when the safety car happened? You're like, oh, look at that.
Look, I thought it was an impressive pole and impressive defense from Bottas, and then it all sort of fell apart from there. Not helped by the safety car, for sure.
Not helped by the safety car. My God. If it were... Well, okay. We'll leave it at that. Yes, there's no argument that Hamilton is great. Hamilton is great. But I think Bottas did extremely well, and I credit luck for Bottas's result more than you do.
Okay.
Now, Sebastian Vettel. My goodness.
It just keeps getting worse and worse, doesn't it?
Oh, Jesus. I mean, so let's talk about the stewards again. They deemed it a racing incident. They didn't penalize either driver. But I looked at that move, and I thought it was 100% Vettel's fault.
Well, that was that. He apologized for it. It was awful.
It was a boneheaded move.
Yeah. It was a rookie mistake from a four-time world champion.
I don't know what to say. I mean, his fall from grace has been so stark and severe and just comprehensive. I mean, he's just... It's just becoming... He needs to get himself mentally refocused. He's just completely out of sorts.
Yeah, he was blown away for pace. I mean, he was nowhere near the ultimate pace of Leclerc in quali. He was going to beat Gasly, but he was nowhere near Leclerc or Verstappen in the race, was he? And then he made that move. And the club corner is a tight corner anyway. We've seen how many accidents at that corner on that left-hander?
Yeah.
And, you know, he was never going down the inside. But I'll tell you what it did show is how strong Formula One cars are. That front wing wasn't damaged. That was amazing.
Yeah.
He lifted the whole of that Red Bull and somehow he didn't break his car. They changed the wing. I don't know why, because it didn't make it any quicker.
Well, he definitely scuffed it up.
Yeah, you're right, there's some tire marks on it.
There are definitely some tire marks. But, I think the wing, they're probably harder to see on television bits that probably were damaged. Damaged enough to spend the extra 10 seconds, 8 seconds it was, to get it changed. I don't know enough to say, but, I mean, look, I think much more importantly, we know that Vettel's a better driver than this. I mean, he's a much better driver than this. So
it's going the way of his Ricciardo season at Red Bull, though, isn't it? It's starting to unravel pretty quickly.
I think worse than myself. I think it's a genuine fall from grace here, and I'm just more and more convinced that his head's not been in the right place since the German Grand Prix last year, where he was leading the race in control and he spun off on his own. And ever since then, there's just been lots of mistakes like this.
Well, shockingly, we're quickly coming across the anniversary of that race.
Yeah, yeah, I know. It's the next round.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, some people are saying that he hasn't gotten over Canada yet, which is possibly true. But, I mean, how long does it take? You just get on with it, don't you? You put it out of your mind. You crack on. The Ferrari was far more competitive at Silverstone than anyone expected.
Well, let's not forget that it was Churchill that said, keep calm and carry on, not Mussolini. So.
Or his buddy Adolf. You're right.
But. Yeah. Yeah. That's why I was like, I'll just go for the Italian one. I didn't want to bring him up. But, like, yeah. I mean, you see my... I don't know what to say, but, like, you know, even Canada, he made a mistake.
Yeah.
Whether the stewards made the right or the wrong call, wherever you land on that, it still started with his mistake. He took the car off the track, and that's what caused the controversy at Canada. It was his mistake.
But he's got to pull himself together because...
Exactly.
You know, where does he go from Ferrari? I don't think he goes... He doesn't go into a Mercedes or a Red Bull. So it's the only way is down. So he's got to pull himself together and stay at Ferrari and hope to God that they actually produce a decent championship-winning car before he retires. That's his best
now, hold
hope
on.
For another championship.
Let's. I'm sure Kimi Raikkonen would love to have his faithful number two driver back with him at Alfa Romeo.
I was impressed. Kimi was up to fourth in Austria. He's still Kimi's, got it, you know. He's still got it, that chap.
Kimi's fantastic. And his attitude about the whole thing. The irony is that before Kimi would even meet me, I'd be so in the hole. Because I'm a journalist. Automotive journalist, motorsports journalist, doesn't matter. I'm a journalist. He would dislike me. I'm almost certain of it. You know? And it's like, well, damn. But I think so highly of you. But, you know, what can you do?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough position. You can just see Charles getting stronger and stronger. He's getting more and more comfortable. He's got on top of his qualifying woes. I can see him winning a race very, very soon. And he would deserve a race win, I think. Vettel's in a tough spot, no doubt about it.
Well, what did you think of Leclerc's performance at the British Grand Prix?
That was great. I mean, clearly the pace of the Ferrari wasn't quite as good in the race as it was in qualifying, and he had his hands full keeping Verstappen behind him. And the battle raged on the track, in the pit lane, back on the track. I mean, he got pipped in the pit lane, managed to get Verstappen immediately on exiting the pit lane when yep. Verstappen's tires were cold. Very quick thinking there, and just his defence was robust but clean. But he gave Verstappen everything, every bit as good as he got from him. And it was great racing by both of them, actually. And they didn't take each other off. They didn't do anything stupid. And he absolutely deserved his podium position, I think.
Yeah. No arguments there. And I thought that... I'm going to say it again just in this context. I thought Pierre Gasly's performance improved from where he has been. But we're now going to be talking about... Gasly seems to be in like a Nick Heidfeld kind of position. Nick Heidfeld always seemed to find amazing amounts of performance when his job was on the line. And I swear to God, his job was on the line like four or five times
over a couple of seasons.
That's
a good point. There was always a few drivers who would drive really well when their contract was up for renegotiation and then immediately plumb the depths after signing.
Right, yeah.
And like Trump was one of those, you're right.
Definitely so. And I feel like I'm wondering if we don't know if Gasly's if this is who he is, or is this just he's young yet and he's still learning and he's a slow learner compared to others.
We had a good season last year. He had some good races last year.
Last year, yeah, in the Toro Rosso. But I mean learning the big team, maybe there's something about it that's uncomfortable. I don't know.
Well, he's slow. That's
a What did you think of Carlos? Because Carlos has been only so-so, but you know, sixth place result in the McLaren, that was definitely a good improvement.
Before I answer that question, I do want to make this one announcement. Vettel's woes did have one positive to it. We can officially say that both Williams cars beat a Ferrari at the British Grand Prix, and they were all very happy about that.
Yes, well.
Yeah, Carlos got lucky, didn't he? McLaren... You know, made a real hash of Norris's race and didn't pit him in the safety car, and he had to pit under the green flag, and that screwed his race. And the same happened to Albon. In fact, Albon's maladies were even worse than that. They told him not to pit because the Honda had some sort of electrical issue, and they were too scared to touch it, so they just kept running on tires until they. So Honda's not quite there yet, but no, I mean science. Sainz had a strong race, and it's a really good battle now between McLaren and Renault, because Renault bounced back at Britain. And both him and Hulkenberg, not Rosberg, both had a good run, finished in the top 10.
Yeah, definitely so. Okay, let's go to the other end of the finishing order. Haas. I mean, you know, lap one. I don't think it was turn one, maybe two or turn two or three. You know, wasn't great.
They've got real problems. I mean, so in Austria, Magnussen qualified fifth. He didn't start fifth because of the penalty, but
right.
But they then finished just ahead of the Williamses, so they got no race pace at all. And it was, you know, I mean, they might as well have hit each other and took themselves off at Britain, because they didn't have any race pace there either. I mean, they are apparently they ran on Grosjean's car, the Australia setup. So that's how clueless they are. I have no idea what they're doing,
right,
to get the tires to work.
I read that as well, and I was kind of shocked to hear that. But Gunther Steiner is starting to throw out the little. I'm not so sure. Maybe it's the drivers.
Oh, come on, no, that's passing the buck. That is, it's him and his technical team not understanding the car. I mean, those two have been there for what since Haas started. Couple of seasons now, they deliver.
Well, Grosjean, since Haas started, Magnussen replaced Gutierrez.
Okay, but they've delivered when the cars have performed. So I think that's really not looking in the right place, quite frankly.
Well, let's just play this theoretical game. They decide one of them has to go, and they call Christopher Roche and say, "Okay, one of the guys has to go. Yeah. Who stays? Who leaves?"
Well, I'll tell you what. I think a Magnussen-Gasly swap would be quite interesting because I think Magnussen would be much more close to the sharp end.
Okay, so you would have Magnussen leave so we could go to a better team.
Yeah.
Theoretically, that means you would have Grosjean leave to just leave.
Oh, I think Grosjean's a pretty good driver too. I think they're both decent, actually. I mean, Grosjean has had his moments, let's be honest. The pace car crash last year was pretty epic. That's one of my all-time favourites, that one. But he is quick. I don't think there's anybody who doubts that Grosjean's quick.
Yeah, but you know who else was quick?
Not Nick Heidfeld.
Pastor Maldonado was quick.
Yeah, well, occasionally.
Yeah. And Grosjean is Pastor Maldonado. He just didn't look like it because Pastor Maldonado was around. But...
no,
but
I mean,
his strong performance to... making mistakes ratio is higher than most.
No, there's some major structural issues it has. It's a technical problem. They got to figure that out. It is nothing to do with the drivers. Yeah, okay, the drivers shouldn't really hit each other in a race. That's rule number one.
Good, that's a good insight.
Yeah,
they just shouldn't hit each other.
We all know that, they know that. But the race pace, that's very much on Gunther, I'm afraid.
All right, so British Grand Prix, we both agree it was a great race to watch in general. Is there any other things you want to talk about that specific Grand Prix?
Yeah, two quick things. So first of all, they announced a new Brit deal for 5 years, which was good.
Yes, 5-year extension, yep.
Yeah, because it looked real touch and go, and I'm very fond of Silverstone, so I'm happy to see that still on the calendar. And then you mentioned Carlos, and we didn't really talk about him, but both he and Norris re-signed for McLaren for next year.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that got done and announced before the race, and it was a bit of a no-brainer, really. They both performed really well in the McLaren. McLaren have definitely turned a corner, a little bit like Honda on their own separate ways. They're both improved dramatically since the...
Yeah. Yeah, no, and Lando has definitely proven himself. I completely agree. Although, that does remind me, did you happen to see... the pre-race stuff in Britain where Lando Norris was driving Martin Brundle around in a McLaren?
Oh, I didn't see that, no.
Oh,
I'll have to check that out. Was it entertaining?
It was. Lando managed to spin off and get stuck in the gravel trap.
Oh, that's funny. And Martin probably told him what he thought of it.
Well, but Martin was he was just having fun with it and, you know, lighting the mood because Lando was properly embarrassed with himself.
Yeah. Sorry, go on.
No, you go ahead.
I did see a couple of laps that Lewis Hamilton did with Frank Williams in the car. Do you see that one? That was on the F1.com.
No.
Yeah, they got old Frank in the car and Lewis took him for a couple of hot laps and Frank loved it, really loved it. It was really cool, really cool video.
Oh, good. Yeah, because Frank, I mean... I could only assume his health has debilitated some because he hasn't been going to the race as much.
Yeah, I think it's you know, as he's getting on in years, it's not getting any easier, is it? But yeah, he was there with Claire, you know, your favourite, and team principal. And they stuck him in the car and Lewis gave him a good old ride, that's for sure. He didn't stick it in the gravel trap, though. And it was noted that he was slightly quicker than Bottas on the same tyres.
Good. That's very good. Well, I do want to point out that it in the championship, it is, in fact, Lewis Hamilton leading with 223 points, followed by his teammate with 184. So that puts him comfortably over a race win ahead of, in points. And then Max Verstappen is now in third place in the Red Bull Honda. That's Honda with 136 points, which is also a lot closer to 100 points behind. So any non-Mercedes, it's just, they're just crushing it. Fourth place is Sebastian Vettel with 123 points. Fifth place, his teammate Charles Leclerc with 120. So that might change quite soon. It is sixth place. It is Pierre Gasly. So it is the top three teams in the top six positions here. Yeah, he Gasly's has 55 points.
100 points behind his teammate.
Yeah, well, just 75. Oh, no, you're right. No, you're right. It is close to 100. Sorry, I was looking at Vettel. And then the lead non-top three team guy is Carlos Sainz in the McLaren-Renault with 38. And then Kimi Raikkonen in eighth place with 25 points in the Alfa Romeo Racing Ferrari. Lando Norris is ninth in the second McLaren. And Daniel Ricciardo is ahead of his teammate Nico Rosberg. They're 10th and 11th in the championship with 22 points and... What did I say? I said Hulk. Did I really?
You did.
Why? No, I'm gonna check the tape.
Play the tape back.
Nico Hulkenberg is behind Daniel Ricciardo. He has 17 points. Daniel Ricciardo has 22. Hey, Nico Rosberg won the championship in 2016.
There's no other Nicos. We just call him Nico from now on, all right?
That'll be easy. Oh, man. Kevin Magnussen is in 12th place with 14 points. Sergio Perez, 13 points in 13th. Daniel Kvyat is 14th with 12. Alexander Albon, 15th with 7. 16th, Lance Stroll with 6. Romain Grosjean, 17th with 2. So, boy, I mean, I don't know. That's pretty stark between Magnussen and Grosjean. Antonio Giovinazzi has 1 point, and neither George Russell nor Robert Kubica have a point between them. In the constructor standings, it is Mercedes with, we're not halfway through yet, 407 points compared to Ferrari's 243. Wow.
So an annihilation, I think is the word.
And Red Bull Racing Honda has 191 in third. McLaren is fourth with 60. Renault is fifth with 39. Alfa Romeo sixth with 26. Racing Point seventh with 19th. Scuderia Toro Rosso eighth with 19. Haas Ferrari ninth with 16 points. And then poor old Williams still stuck in 10th place. But that is all I have to say about Formula One. And it is now for my daily, well, podcast, every podcast reminder that IndyCar racing is awesome. It was another fantastic race in Toronto. That's where they were most recently. Same weekend as Britain. It was Romain Grosjean. No, it was Simon Pagenaud. It was a different Frenchman. It was Simon Pagenaud that put on an application. He won the race. He was on pole and won the race. So he's having a fantastic season after a pretty bad drought in 2018. So he did very well. The guy that's kind of having a meltdown, Sebastian Vettel-esque meltdown, and you could argue worse in IndyCar, is Will Power. He had a lap one, turn eight incidents where he tried to go way inside, three wide into a tight right-hander corner, like a 50, 60-mile-an-hour corner in an Indy car, and just spun two other guys and took himself way back into the points. And then he worked his way, Carlos Bay, way back up into fifth or sixth or whatever it was. And then the last lap, he had another accident in turn eight again, by himself, and just ended his race. And yeah, so it's just not, he was champion only once, but he was IndyCar champion in 2014. He's won a ton of races. He's super, super quick, but he's just falling apart.
What did Roger have to say on that?
I haven't seen any reports from Roger, but that, I mean, Roger and Gunther Steiner are two very different people.
So, but neither of them are impressed by driver incompetence. So I think that's the one thing they have in common.
This is very true. Excuse me. So, yeah, that's my little IndyCar ruling. But if you didn't watch that race, you missed out. It was really good. And to be fair, I didn't watch the whole race. I still have it taped. I'm about a third of the way through.
Okay. Are you going to give us an update on Formula E too?
No, other than the championship is over and sure. John Egvern won that championship. Oh, congratulations to him. And also,
French are dominating every series apart from Pierre Gasly.
There you go. Well, hold on now. Because in IMSA racing, the last two races, it was at the Glen and then at Mossport, Team Mazda, Team Yost with Mazda has won the last two races and they've broken through. So, and I'm trying to think, I don't think they have any French drivers. No. American, Brit, I think he's a Spaniard. Yeah, no French there. So.
Are you following Formula W or whatever they call it as well?
Oh, I mean, no, I'm not following. I'm aware of it.
Well, the young lady, Jamie Chadwick, who's thrashing everyone in Formula W, has been given a development drive by Williams, which I thought was quite an interesting development.
Oh, good for them. Well, and Williams, of course, had Susie Wolf in it beforehand as well. So they've been pro 2X chromosomes longer than most, I would say. Is that fair? It's kind of ironic, actually, that they've done that, and you'd think Red Bull would be more cutting edge when it comes to that kind of stuff. But maybe they're not. I mean, actually, no. That's no surprise at all, considering the comments that Helmut Marko had to say about the Formula W series. He was basically, it was one step away from women should stay in the kitchen.
Oh my goodness.
He was like, oh, the women aren't strong enough in the upper body and they don't have the mental toughness. He said those types of things.
I mean, I was actually shocked at the backlash from the Formula. People, I mean, on all, you know, both sexes coming out and saying it's outrageous that they have to have segregated motorsport for men and women. It's like, seriously? I mean, you know, do you see a lot of women in Formula One these days? I think anything we can try that's a little different to give them a helping hand should not be immediately dismissed.
Well, that's just it. It's like, shouldn't they just be able to race on equal terms with the guys? And the answer is, yeah, but they're not. They don't. So this is a way to help bridge the gap. Yeah. I'm with you there.
So, I mean, I think the interesting point is that people like Chadwick have been competitive in mixed formula, and she'll do one series of Formula W, presumably go back to a mixed formula and continue to be competitive. This just gives her a bigger bank account with which to get a better seat. So, yeah. good tactics.
Yeah. I do want to say that I was at my very first Pikes Peak International Hill Climb a couple weeks ago. And that was, turned out to be a very tragic hill climb event. Carlin Dune, a veteran hill climber and I believe it was Ducati factory rider, he passed away. He had an accident and apparently his off was something like 20 yards from the finish line. It was the last corner or penultimate corner before he got to the checkered. And the way the Pikes Peak Mountain is split up, it's, I think the course is 13 miles or thereabouts, 12 and a half, 13 miles. And it's broken into four sectors. And during his run, I was watching a video screen that had the sector times put up. And the motorcycles run before the cars. So we saw the first sector go by, FTD, fastest time of the day. Second sector go by, FTD. Third sector go by, FTD. And then minutes went by, no fourth sector. Then more minutes, then more, and then time. And then it was like 20 minutes, and it really started looking. And then probably 45 minutes later, news came over that he had an off, and he's going to be airlifted to the hospital, but he's going to be okay. Like broken bones, but his vitals are all strong. Okay. The hill climb eventually gets underway again. More things are coming. Some other drama happens. Some weather comes and throws some people off, stuff like that. And then, you know, probably three quarters through the day where all the drivers getting through, news come through. By the way, his vitals weren't okay, and he's passed away. Wow. So, yeah, so it was a pretty, it was very somber tone. And we got the news as we were leaving the mountain, because the way it works is the cars go in order of their qualifying, which is logical enough. So the fastest car that qualified goes first, slowest car goes last. And I was with Acura on this trip. It was an Acura trip. That's right. And all the Acuras, like the factory Acuras had gone, and like the top guys had gone. And so the consensus was we can leave and get the rest of the race via news related. It was on the way home that we heard about Carlin Doon. But, you know, it was in fact a Honda powered car that, it was an open wheel dune buggy that had the fastest time of the year. Not fast time overall. No one's even close to the Volkswagen ID race car that, is it Romain Dumas raced up under 8 minutes. No one's close to that, but this year fastest was an open wheel buggy. Peter Cunningham was in his former Speed World Challenge car that's been modified for Pikes Peak. He was third overall and fastest in the open class. And then about halfway through the run, it started raining and it screwed up everybody's time. And then it started raining hard, and they only went halfway up the mountain for the last 20 cars or something like that. So pretty interesting event.
I mean, so obviously that's terrible news. But as an event, I mean, what's your, obviously maybe colored a little bit by that tragedy, but I mean, would you recommend it as a motorsport event?
It's definitely a bucket list item, I would say. It is, you know, I wrote a couple articles about it. I think I shared them on the Fun with Cars Facebook page. It is remarkable. It's quite unique because it's a 10 minute long hill climb. Mm-hmm. That's 12 and a half miles long, starting at 9,400 feet above sea level, finishing at over 14,000 feet above sea level. So engine power drops by 25% from start to finish. And there's times when you're driving on what looks like a normal country road, and then there's times where if you understeer off the course, there's no guardrail, and you're dropping for 1,000 feet. Now, it's not a cliff face, but it is a, you know, 45-degree angle, sometimes 60-degree angle drop. And so there are some real proper risks that are pretty amazing to see, and the variety of cars, and some of them, like, you know, lots of manufacturers put big serious millions of dollars into it to make these epic cars, but then there's still a lot of guys that are kind of like shade tree mechanics building it in the back of their shed type of folks that go and run the mountain. So it's a really interesting variety of manufacturer to, you know, real local people doing this. So yeah, it's definitely something to see. It's not inherently exciting because it's one at a time, only every couple minutes, and you can only see a few corners, yeah, inevitably, you know. But it's definitely an experience, and the paddock is certainly unique. It's a cool area for sure.
Did you get a run up the hill?
I got a very slow run up the hill the day before.
Okay.
Yeah, to see what it was. And I got a couple donuts, and I got a coffee mug.
Okay, good.
Yeah, and apparently the donuts, their specific recipe, they were good donuts, and the donuts, they have to be made at altitude because they taste distinctly different at altitude compared to being done at close to sea level. So some anomaly in the cooking and the frying.
Interesting. Did it taste, yeah, better or just different?
I have nothing to compare it to.
So you didn't do a taste test at sea level and
I've had donuts at sea level and I've had donuts up high, but they were also very different recipes. Okay. It's not like it's a Tim Hortons up there. You know what I mean? It's not a corporate thing. It's a very local thing. So, but anyway, yeah, I would definitely recommend it once, but not necessarily as anything. But you know, it's cool stuff going on. Like some of the cars are quite cool. Some of the cars are quite like, from an engineering point of view, you look at it and you're like, I don't think that makes sense. But then like, you know, Porsche brought some GT4 cars. They had like three or four of them go up there. I think Travis Pastrana was in one of them. You know, so you'll get some big names like that. Yeah, so it's definitely a cool event. And there's this really cool festival in Colorado Springs, which is the nearest town, a couple days before the event. That's super cool. You know, it's like a car show festival type of thing. So, yeah. Sweet. So I guess, yes, I would recommend it.
So how many things are left on your bucket list?
On my bucket list?
Yeah, I mean, motorsport-wise, yeah.
Well, let's see. Help me count. Winning the Formula One championship.
No. Realistic.
Winning Monaco.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I'm being realistic.
I'd love to go to Monaco Grand Prix. Love to go to Monza.
Yeah. I'd love to do both of those as well. I'd really love to go to Suzuka. I was lucky enough to go to Spa once, but I'd love to see the Formula One cars around Spa. I'd love to go to Bathurst. Oh, yeah. See the V8 cool. supercars. Mm-hmm. And Isle of Man. That just seems absolutely crazy. Mm,
yeah.
24 hours in Nürburgring for sure.
Yeah, that's a good one.
All joking aside, this is one that probably is not on your list. IndyCars at Laguna Seca. That is something I definitely want to do. And they are racing there again starting this year. So,
well, I should go and do the 500 at some point. I almost did it this year, but I didn't.
Yeah, I know. Remember, we're talking about Alonso. But, I genuinely want to get behind the wheel some more and do some of that. But, yeah, obviously that's a different kind of bucket list.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, we digress, right?
That's what we do.
I do want to let you know that the next Formula One race is the German Grand Prix, and that's on the 28th of July. IndyCar's next race is just a few days away. That's Iowa 300. That's July 20th. The World Endurance Championship is going to start again at the 4 hours of Silverstone, September 1st. The next IMSA race is at Lime Rock in Connecticut, and that is called the Northeast Grand Prix, and that is also on July 20th. And I want to thank you for listening. Please take a moment to review us on iTunes or on whatever platform you get our podcasts. Please leave comments on the episode of your choice by going to funwithcars.com. As always, I can be reached at feedback@funwithcars.com. Tweet us at fun_with_cars. And check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/FWCars. Chris, we did it again. Your patience is lovely. Thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm Robin Warner. Goodbye.